Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening.
Hello, everybody. It's Helen Caldicott. I'm in London. Welcome to the show. And this is an update about Fukushima, I think how the Japanese pronounce it. Yesterday, the Japanese government raised the accident to a level 7. Now, level 7 is the worst. It's the same as Chernobyl. And it means that many, many countries will be contaminated by radioactive fallout. The truth is this accident has only just begun. Unit 1 is still having areas of criticality, meaning that it's fissioning in various areas. I won't go into how or why at this stage. And the reason they're injecting nitrogen into the core is because the fissioning can produce hydrogen. And as the pressure drops in reactor 1, which it has been doing, that allows oxygen to rush in the air, and there could be a hydrogen explosion. So that's number 1. Reactor number 2 has actually melted down through the containment vessel and hit the floor of the concrete. And that could react with the concrete, producing hydrogen and a massive explosion, either steam or hydrogen, releasing its contents. Reactor 3 has burst its containment. Reactor 3 contains MOX fuel rods, meaning that they're mixed oxide fuel, plutonium and uranium, terribly, terribly dangerous. And reactor 3, of course, has been leaking enormously, and that's a great danger too. Plutonium has been found 1.5 to 2 miles from the reactor complex, and that is probably coming from cooling pool 4, number 4. Reactor 4 has no fuel rods in it. They were taken out to be replaced. Well, it may have some, but the fuel rods in cooling pool 4 are very recent, very hot, thermally, and very radioactive. And it's thought that during the hydrogen explosion, that cooling pool, most of the rods were sent out into the air and landed all over the place. Now, cooling pools contain 2 to 10 times more radiation than in the reactor core itself. The reactor core contains as much radiation, long-lived, as that released by 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. So you can imagine what that means. In fact, it has been reported that reactor 4 cooling pool is empty, and that is incredibly serious. And there has been report too that another cooling pool is empty. That they still haven't got the pumps working that need to be worked, so they're still spraying water on the reactors and the cooling pools. I mean, the thing is a hell of a mess. The Japanese Prime Minister said it might take months to years to fix. Yet, this morning, even after yesterday when they raised the level to 7, which is the most serious nuclear accident there can be with reactors, the Japanese Prime Minister said this morning, let's get back life to normal and let's get on with things. So, look, I think they're confused, they're frightened, they're covering up, they don't really know what's going on because this is totally new scenario. Nobody has ever had to confront 4 reactors melting down, built on an earthquake fault, with cooling pools, hydrogen explosions, and no way to control it. This isn't in the literature. So we're sitting on a catastrophe of major proportions, which will contaminate much of the Northern Hemisphere, as did Chernobyl. The two air masses at the equator do not mix, and therefore there will be little fallout, in the southern hemisphere, except that radiation from Chernobyl has actually been found at the South Pole. So we're facing a very, very, very uncertain future. It's kind of like having a nuclear war without the explosions. Now we'll go to the regular program. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Subhanka Banerjee, an Indian-born American photographer, writer, and activist. Over the past decade, he's focused much of his attention on issues of ecological conservation, indigenous human rights, and climate change in Alaska, the Yukon, and Siberia, and more recently on the impact of climate on the desert ecosystem near his home in New Mexico. His work has been instrumental in fighting oil and gas development, both onshore and offshore in Arctic Alaska, including Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Teshikpuk Lake Wetland, Beaufort, and Chukchi Seas. His photographs have been shown in more than 50 museums and galleries in the US, Europe, and Mexico, and published in over 200 magazines and newspapers around the world, including the New York Review of Books and Vanity Fair. In 2010, Subhanka founded climatestorytellers.org. He's received many awards, including the Lannan Foundation Cultural Freedom Fellowship, and was appointed Director's Visitor at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton for the fall term of 2011. Welcome to the program, Subhanka.
It's thrilling to be speaking with you, Helen.
So, Subhanka, what's your background? How did you get into this ecology stuff and photography in the first place?
Well, I'll have to give you a little background. My life has been nothing but a zigzag path, and as soon as I get on one bend, it changes to something else.
Yes, that's a bit like mine.
Exactly. And I never know what I'm going to do next. No. But I was born in India, grew up there.
Where, in Calcutta?
Actually, not in Calcutta. There I came later in life when I was in eighth grade, mostly rural Bengal, because yes. My dad was in banking and we moved around every 3 years or so. So rural Bengal.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually got interested in art very early in my life because my granduncle was a painter. He taught me how to do all that. But having grown up in a middle-income family, I never thought I could make a living at it. So I went into usual thing like science and engineering, did my undergrad in engineering, then came to U.S., did graduate studies in theoretical physics and also in computer science, and worked in the scientific fields for 6 years for Los Alamos National Lab.
Oh, no.
What? Out of all places.
What were you doing there, for God's sake?
Los Alamos at that time, they still do, had a lab called Advanced Computing Lab. So we were looking at more, actually it was a positive work in the sense looking at large-scale solutions for plasma research for clean energy, but it turned into something quite horrendous, and I left after 2 years, became a very defense-oriented project.
What did it turn into?
Well, what happened is Los Alamos, the project that we were doing, was going to be a plasma physics research. Most of the scientists were actually Princeton plasma physicists. And then they got this big, huge grant because Department of Energy, I guess, was cutting grants. So they got the grant from the Department of Defense called ASCII, Accelerated Strategic Computing Initiative, which is the most horrendous modeling of bombs to kill massive things without ever actually having to experiment it. So it's, in a way it's good, but in a way it's horrendous things they were modeling. And it was a $1 billion project, believe it or not. So right at that time, I decided to bail and went to Boeing in Seattle.
Boeing? Boeing's also preparing for Star Wars. Oh, my God.
Horrible defense issues and everything else. But I, you know, I had been almost contemplating because I fell in love with the land in New Mexico and started backpacking, hiking, got involved with Sierra Club and conservation issues, and decided to dump my scientific career to become kind of an artist without really any kind of a pretension where what I'm going to do or anything, but I actually dumped my career without knowing what I'm going to do rather than keeping one foot here, one foot there.
Mm.
And then by kind of serendipity, I went to the subarctic in Canada and from there to the Arctic. And ever since, it's just my life changed.
Well, how did you become a photographer then?
So when I was in New Mexico, actually during graduate school, I was doing all these hikes and backpacks, and I became the outings chair for the local Sierra Club group and then became vice chair. And I used to lead a lot of hiking, backpacking, mountaineering trips. So at that time, I always had art in my, I guess, blood. So I picked up a camera, nothing big, just a single reflex camera, and I was photographing just like that. Joined a photography class and a painting class at the university, but kind of dropped them because of the pressure from physics. And then when I went to Seattle, I took it more seriously. But I was never really trained in it. It's all self-taught. But in Seattle, I joined the mountaineers and started doing trips and kind of learned the trade from the friends, and I just felt I was ready because the technical aspect was easy for me. I just needed to figure out kind of the aesthetic and why am I doing it. And so photography kind of came a little bit naturally in a way because of my outdoor experiences, and then I just went from there.
Isn't it interesting though, Sabanka, that as a physicist and a computer scientist, the two jobs you got were in, and I don't call it defense, I call it offense and war, in Los Alamos Labs, blowing up millions or billions of people, and Boeing, which develops all the rockets for Star Wars and missile defense and that, you name it. I mean, I think that's true for many people, Sabanka, that they can only get jobs in the area you were in blowing up the world, so to speak.
Actually, that is true, which is kind of sad. You know, like if you're a physicist, where do you get jobs? You get jobs at these energy labs. Then they're doing horrible research behind the scene that very few people know about.
It's not sad, it's tragic.
So you're very, very right about that, about that, and it's kind of sad.
Well, it's tragic. I just... like,
well, and your work shows throughout 20th century this went on in a very, very tragic manner.
Oh, God. Okay, so, all right, how old are you?
I'm 43 now.
And how long have you been doing this photography-ecological work?
So I have been doing full-time and seriously for the last about 11 years now.
Right.
I left Boeing in 2000, and since then I have been at it. First photography, then got into activism, conservation, and then human rights, and now it's all part of the same thing.
So what took you up to the subarctic in the first place?
Well, like I said, after I left the Boeing job, I was kind of traveling arbitrarily from like Washington State to like Florida, everything in between, just looking for so-called an inspiration.
Mm.
And then kind of like I went to this place called, as part of that, called Churchill in Manitoba. That was October 2000, to look at polar bears and photograph, where all nature photographers go.
Churchillian, Manitoba.
In Manitoba, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's where most nature photographers go to photograph polar bears. And so I did with a couple of friends. And I came back with photographs, but came back with a horrible experience for multiple reasons. One of which mainly was I would see a bear and eight large vehicles would surround the bear to take pictures or view or whatever. Not something why I left the Boeing job. So I was disappointed right there. And kind of an extreme form of tourism. And the second thing, which actually I started talking about only, believe it or not, just last year, is I photographed something quite horrendous, one polar bear eating another polar bear.
Oh, I saw that photograph in your records.
Yeah, and I finally wrote about it. I never published it. I never showed it anywhere. And at that time, I really could not kind of deal with it because this is not normal. Polar bears don't do that. This is totally abnormal. And now we know it's because of climate change. And those bears of the Hudson Bay, the scientists are saying, could disappear as early as within one decade.
Really?
But at most 20 to 30 years, which is just tragic. I mean, it's so that sort of all of those things kind of, I started thinking, well, I need to go to a place in the Arctic which is not impacted by tourism or industry. More of a very romantic notion, which was, of course, shattered over time. But Greenland and Norway and Siberia, all of that seemed very far and expensive. So I thought Alaska might be a possibility. So that's what I started talking with the biologist in Fairbanks at the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And the assistant manager was very helpful, Anne Markle. And she would send me all these various reports. But I said, I want to go there in winter. She said, you must be crazy. Nobody goes there in winter. So then she said, you have to really work with the indigenous people. And she connected me up with Robert Thompson, who has become one of my best friends now, who is a hunter and conservationist and lives in Kaktovik, the Inupiat village. And after 5 months of talking with him and research, then I went there in March of 2001 for the first time.
Mm. And tell us about it.
Well, the very first day was kind of crazy because I got off the plane and it was minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, which is in centigrade the same, minus 40. But I felt fine. I was like dressed properly, and Robert said, let's go walk in the Arctic Ocean, which we did. And then in the evening, he said, I'll take you to Airy Island, which is 6 miles from Kaktovik, where his wife Jane's parents grew up, which is like a little barrier island, which is like a small stretch of island, maybe let's say a few hundred yards wide, mm-hmm. and could be a mile long. And it's kind of all along the Arctic coast, you see these barrier islands. They're very important ecological habitat. But so we went there, and it's of course winter, everything is frozen ice. But the wind picked up, started blowing at 50, 60 miles per hour, wind chill dropped to 90 degrees below zero. And my camera froze, I panicked horrendously, and I just like, what the hell am I doing here? This is not what I thought Arctic would be, and I won't survive this land. Forget about photography. This is way beyond me. I grew up in Calcutta.
Yeah.
So, and then I barely made it back to the village, but Robert and his wife started reassuring that this is nothing. Things will get much worse, but you will survive. So, and I did, because I kind of trusted my life with Robert and Jane, and we took one baby step at a time. And I ended up spending 14 months over a period of 2 years out there in all seasons. That was my first kind of long-term work out there. And, of course, we did, like, so many things to bring out the first ecological record of the region, which challenged the dominant political view of the Bush administration. And they were very threatened by my work, and it all became very political, and that became my education into the American politics,
oh,
which I also knew nothing about.
Now, was Robert, he's an indigenous person?
Yes.
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 And
he's
okay.
Inupiat.
Yeah.
And so is his wife.
Yeah.
Yes.
Inuit. So what?
Yeah. Inuit is the general term all over the circumpolar Arctic.
Yes.
But in Alaska, they call themselves Inupiat, but they're the same.
Same. And
yes.
So describe that 14 months to us in some sort of pre-seed detail.
So basically, you know, the one of the dominant view of the Arctic in winter, because Arctic 9 months is winter, literally. June,
uh-huh.
July, August, 3 months snow-free. But it can snow even in August or July or June. But generally, they're snow-free or ice-free. And the other 9 months is really ice-bound. So the popular conception is that it's a frozen wasteland of snow and ice. So there is no life out there. And what my work with Robert proved, that there is life every day out there in all seasons. Like the polar bears are denning during the winter months. The muskox, which is actually the most adapted of all Arctic animals, more so than even polar bears, because their wool is the warmest wool in the world called Kivyut. They give birth in April when the ground is completely covered in snow.
Goodness.
The temperature can be 40 below zero, and they have these tiny little babies.
Goodness.
That are born in April.
Huh.
So, and then there are 6-7 species of birds that live there all winter long, including one species. I'll share one quick experience with Robert. Always used to talk about this one bird that when he's hunting in winter would dip in the water and come out with food. And I said, that's not possible. How could there be water in 50 below zero? But as it turns out, there is water even in minus 50 degrees Fahrenheit because of these various warm springs activities.
Mm.
And there is one species they call it water wuzo. It's American dipper. It's a tiny little songbird that actually lives and actually needs that water to survive because it feeds on small invertebrates. In one of those times in November when it's 19-hour darkness, 50 below zero, I photographed actually a dipper dunking in the water, coming out with these tiny little invertebrates.
Goodness.
And it was this amazing kind of a life. And then spring comes and Arctic becomes this most vibrant place of the planet because what happens is 180 species of birds come to this very specific area, Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, from all other continents and almost every land and ocean on the planet. All the birds go up there north, they nest there, they have to finish their duties very quickly, and they have to return to their southern grounds before it starts snowing again. So they are there also June, July, and they start departing in August, 180 species. And then these caribous, they come to the coastal plain, they give birth, more than 100,000 animals, and it's just a remarkable fecundity of life. So it's the area is called the most biological heart of the refuge, is this coastal area, coastal tundra. And that's where the oil is. So it's the most biodiverse in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, is the most biodiverse area in the entire circumpolar north, believe it or not, for various geological and ecological reasons in the entire circumpolar north. Most highest density as well as the diversity of life is there. But it also happens to be the most debated public land in the U.S. history because right underneath all that life is oil and gas. And the politicians and the corporations want to go drill for it. And it is the longest running public debate in the U.S. history, whether to open it up for oil drilling or not. So far, we haven't lost, and it's an ongoing battle.
Well, I'm interviewing Subhanka Banerjee, an Indian-born American photographer, writer, and activist. So, Subhanka, how did you upset the Bush administration with this research that you did?
Well, what happened is after that 14 months of photographing, then my first book came out in 2003, April, but in March we had an advanced copy. And the book title was called Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Seasons of Life and Land. And an advance copy was sent by my publisher to an organization in Washington, D.C. called Alaska Wilderness League. And there was a Senate debate, and the Alaska Wilderness League Executive Director Cindy Shogan brought the copy of my book to Senator Barbara Boxer.
Ah.
And during the Senate debate, Boxer held up my book on the Senate floor, blew up one of my polar bear photos into a large poster size, 4 feet by 5 feet or something, and kind of urged all her colleagues to go see my upcoming exhibition, which was to open exactly 6 weeks later at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History in a very major, prominent way. Everything was all approved. And the idea was that day, we did not think we are going to win the vote. The expectation was that it would be a 50-50 split because it was Bush's top priority to open this area. And so all day, and when it is a 50-50 split, the vice president, Dick Cheney, is the one who would break that tie.
Yeah.
And he literally, that day, sat in his Senate office because vice president always has an office in the Senate.
Mm.
He sat in his Senate office all day waiting for that vote to be 50-50. But fortunately, Boxer's passionately resulted in a 51-49 vote to their dismay and to our surprise as well. We won the vote. But then, of course, there were calls made from, who knows, the powers of B to the Smithsonian. And I got a call from the Smithsonian Associate Director, who was the curator of my exhibition, Robert Sullivan. It's actually a great story I'll tell you very quickly.
Yes.
So Sullivan called and said that I have good news and bad news. Good news is that I've been fighting for two and a half weeks to keep your exhibition because there has been great pressure to cancel it. So your show is on, but it will be completely diminished in the sense that it won't open in a prominent way. We have to remove it from the upstairs gallery to downstairs. All of the interpretive text completely has to be expunged, completely, 100% of it, just leaving the titles. So I thought, well, you know, I'm a nobody and I just have an exhibition still at the Smithsonian. This is all very exciting. And I was fine. My publisher was fine. But what ended up happening is that it became, believe it or not, one of the largest kind of a media outcry out of that censorship. Because right after that, the Smithsonian PR people started spinning the story. So it ended up being 5 articles in Washington Post within 10 days. There were 3 articles in Los Angeles Times, including an op-ed. There were 3 articles in the New York Times. And then it just went from there, ended up becoming a Senate hearing, which was covered by the National Public Radio, all of it, which was headed by Senator Dick Durbin, because he fought on my behalf. And he said, I'm going to challenge the Bush administration, blah, blah, blah. So there was a Senate hearing. And then after that, which public does not know that much about, there was a Senate investigation. And I was in Washington. I mean, I was in New York. I get a call from this inspector general that you have to come to D.C. And I said, for what? He said, well, I'm investigating this whole matter. And so I went to D.C. and met with him. And he personally told me that somebody has been lying at a very high level, and I'm going to get who it is. But so the investigation started. We don't know what really happened after that. But it was a very scary moment because I was not a citizen at that point.
Yeah.
Neither did I intend it to be at any time soon. But Ted Stevens, who media went after, that he is the one who pulled the plug. But I don't think it was Stevens.
No.
I personally think it probably was Cheney.
Yes.
Because he is by default the head of the Smithsonian.
Really? Oh, is that so?
Yeah.
Oh.
By default, the vice president becomes whatever the honorary chair.
Oh.
And but then again, it's a speculation. I can't say who really did it. But and it may be just as a phone call. But so it ended there in a way. But Ted Stevens then, in a completely unrelated hearing that was going on about some transportation issue or something, pulled out my book, pounded with his fist, and gave a long monologue of how Banerjee and Jimmy Carter are lying to the American public. And the entire transcript was published in the Anchorage Daily News. So I got really scared. I'm like, holy macro, I'm a foreigner, and I'm going to be deported. And right then, the whole Patriot Act was going on, and all of these things. And I'm a nobody. I'm an extreme large amount of debt. And so I was advised to get a citizenship right away. And I did. So I got a citizenship within a very quick order. And because I was told that otherwise you wouldn't be able to fight this fight that you're fighting. And suddenly I had no interest almost in activism, really. And I was just dropped into this and became an activist overnight and to fight this out. And it did. And actually there was an interesting story happened to even the curator who was the associate director, Robert Sullivan, 2 years later or 3 years later. Actually, more recently, maybe 2008 or 2008, Smithsonian did another big, huge show on climate change. And the Bush administration again applied pressure. And what Robert Sullivan did, the same person who curated my show, the show opened in a completely watered-down fashion, but he resigned and he went to Washington Post and broke the whole story, how this administration was pressuring
goodness
the
me.
Smithsonian. So it just, the story never ended. So it was like, really? I mean, so for me, who knew nothing about American politics, started learning about this thing. So he resigned and he went to Washington Post and broke the story that this is what these people are doing.
So what have been the ramifications since that whole thing broke, Sabanka? All of that media, yeah.
First of all, it created this enormous media attention to the Arctic refuge issue, which otherwise would not have been there, and because it was Bush's top priority. So then what ended up happening is California Academy of Sciences revived the exhibition, and the entire exhibition in its original format, and they started traveling it all over the country. But after that, I was in $100,000 debt. I had no idea how I'm going to, because I literally lived with friends for 3 years in their basements or in their living room or whatever. I had no money. And suddenly I get a call out of the blue from Lannan Foundation, because I had no idea how I'll continue my work or how any of this going to move forward, because even the conservation organizations whom I was supporting flatly told me, I requested only a $2,000 salary a month, and they said, sorry, we can't really help you. And these are all 100 millionaires I'm talking about. So I was like, my God, what am I going to do? So then I gave a talk at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks in October, I remember, of 2003, and 900 people came to the talk. And the next day I was on the front page of the newspaper along with Tate Stevens for two different stories. We shared the front page, and I get a call out of the blue from Lennon Foundation, and they said, we are giving you $500,000 completely unrestricted to whatever you want.
Oh, boy.
And I never even heard of this foundation, who they are, what they are about. And so what we ended up doing is we used that money. I took the $100,000, even though that is not how they said, it's your money, do whatever you want. But I paid off the debt, and then $400,000 I used for public outreach.
Mm.
So we donated 10,000 copies of the book to activists, students, and libraries all across the Arctic, not just in the U.S., Canada, Greenland, all over. And then we did 25 events in cities across the country, in all of which I was able to bring in my indigenous friends, both the Inupiat as well as the Gwich'in. And then California Academy of Sciences created 8 more exhibitions. So I had 9 exhibitions traveling simultaneously the United States. So we were able to place it literally within a very short order. We were able to reach 10, 20 million, 30 million people through the exhibitions, the media that got coverage from that. And we believe that it really helped the refuge during the Bush era because there was nothing else we could have done.
No.
And even in a very odd manner, 2005, when it was the most difficult year, we did not think we were going to win. We still won. And at that year, I took a different tack. I kind of designed an ad that was placed full page in the A section of the New York Times, Washington Post, and USA Today. We don't, again, know what the impact it was, but we won the vote again. So it's like, it's very hard to say what really does what, but we were very active. We were able to get young people all across the country energized in the activism, and of course during the Bush era, if you remember, the progressive sides really were taking it on, and we were just all in it. I mean, we were really fighting it out hard, and we ended up saving the place during that time.
I'm interviewing Subanka Banerjee, an Indian-born American photographer, writer, and activist. Okay, so when the Bush administration ended and Obama was elected, what has happened since then about the Arctic and coal and oil and gas and the incredible wildlife there?
Well, that's the little bit of the sad part of the story, because when Obama came, we thought, my God, now we can really rest and relax and I could have a little vacation and whatever. But absolutely not. As soon as Obama came in, he gave his Department of Interior approved shale oil to drill for oil in America's Arctic Ocean.
Shale.
The entire Arctic Ocean, the Beaufort Sea and the Chukchi Sea. And shale had actually bought the lease during the Bush era, but they did not have the permit to go drill, which the Obama's Department of Interior gave them in October 2009.
Why did they do that?
Well, this is a big mystery, because only reason I can think of is that Arctic is kind of out of sight, out of mind. Even if shit happens, it happens out there, few people will know and care about. It's my personal feeling. I mean, I don't know how. So Obama went ahead and did that. So in a way, we were back in the game. And what we were doing at that time, because I work very closely with indigenous communities and the environmental organizations, only way to fight that then, because it's no longer Congress, it's no longer the legislative branch, its executive branch has already given the go-ahead. So how do you fight?
Mm.
You have the last resort, which is legal. So we filed a lot of legal suits. And by we, I mean the native village of Point Hope and Inupiat community.
Yeah.
And the environmental organizations through something called the Earth Justice, which is a legal nonprofit organizations with lawyers. So I had written a lot of these declarations for the Beaufort Sea and the Chukchi Sea lawsuit, and I was also learning about the whole process of the legal side, which I did not know. And then happened the BP spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And to the great surprise, we thought, my God, this is probably going to stop it. Oh, no, before that, on March, end of March, President Obama, in front of a F-18 fighter jet, which very ironically was apparently a green fighter jet, believe it or not, because it runs on green biodiesel, but it's nevertheless it's a F-15 fighter jet to kill people. He stood in front of that and announced that entire Arctic Ocean will be open for drilling by shale oil.
Good God.
So he did that. We already lost a legal suit. Then came BP spill. Then there was another suit. And May 5th, that also got lost. So then there was nothing else. Like, what do you do then? So I was never considered myself a writer. I mean, even though I had written for scholarly publications, but I never thought of writing in a popular way. So I took on writing, and I actually published the first piece in Tom Dispatch, which you might know, your listeners might know.
It's Tom Dispatch, yes.
Yeah, it's one of the key places for War and Peace. I published there because the editor, Tom Engelhardt, is a dear friend, and it went viral from there. It went all over the place. I was able to get, I'm very close friends with Senator Dick Durbin and Senator Barbara Boxer, so I got it to them and said, please get it to President Obama's hand, and they ensured me that it will, and in a very weird way, on the 27th of May at about 10:30 Eastern time, President Obama came out and said, no, Arctic drilling will still go on as we investigate the BP spill. And then for whatever reason, late into that night, that day, he announced the suspension on Arctic drilling.
Did he?
He did, that day. So we realized that, okay, we got a little breather, but then Shell launched a massive ad campaign. I mean, tens of millions of dollars they spent. It was absolutely blasting the media space, both progressive and conservative. And so I went on to a massive writing mode. So I was just writing these articles without knowing what its impact it will be. And finally, we won it. This year, the Environmental Protection Agency canceled Shell's air quality permit. So without that, Shell cannot really go there. And my writing probably pissed off the Shell people because I got an email from the Shell headquarters in the Netherlands where their global policy head wanted to discuss with me.
Yeah.
And I was scared again because, you know, I mean, it's like not scared, but I was ready to talk with him. But by the time I came back from India, the EPA board had canceled Shell's permit. And now the Republicans are trying to kill the EPA. So it's all over again. So we are in a, I think we are in a bigger fight than during the Bush administration right now.
So how much oil and natural gas and coal is in that area, which is the richest, probably, wildlife habitat in the world?
It is.
Sabanka.
And, you know, the, I mean, I've been talking too much about the politics. Let me come back to the wildlife part a little bit and the indigenous part, the human rights issues. Is truly this part of the Arctic Alaska we are talking about, and the same in Siberia because I've been there too, is amazingly ecologically rich, because what my work is trying to bring out is the interconnections, that Arctic is not an isolated place the way we think, but it's connected to everybody's life, meaning a tiny songbird called a yellow wagtail that winters just outside of Calcutta. Believe it or not, you can just go to the Wikipedia page of yellow wagtail. You will see it, photographs just outside of Calcutta. That same bird goes to the Arctic. Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and nest there. So it's just an example. There are birds coming all over Australia going to the Arctic to nest. And few people think of it that way. Every corner of the earth, these birds go to the Arctic to nest.
Why do they go to the Arctic to nest? I really don't understand that. Is it because it's safe? It mustn't be that. What is it?
That's a great question, and I'm glad you brought that up, Helen. Because the reason these birds go there, and it's a kind of a thing that has happened, I guess, with their evolutionary process, is for food.
Oh.
Only one word, food, that's it. Because what happens in the Arctic all summer long, from May through August, it's 24 hours daylight. That's one thing.
Yeah.
So it's 24 hours feeding opportunities. Second thing is that the Arctic tundra, that you won't see it, but if you're camping there, it's horrendous because of mosquitoes.
Oh, yeah, so I couldn't stand that.
Yeah, absolutely, right? So you probably have seen that, and it's just absolutely nasty. But what's nasty for human beings is food for the birds.
Yeah.
So these birds are gorging on food and raising their young 24 hours a day. So in a way, it has become an evolutionary thing.
Yes.
But the problem is with global warming, all of that is changing, and we'll hopefully get later on about the climate change issues. So you asked about, and it's all true of all of the Arctic, but I want to get back to your question about how much oil and coal is there. And the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, the estimate goes, the U.S. Geological Survey estimate goes somewhere between 7 billion to 16 billion, depending on what is considered economically recoverable.
Is this oil or coal?
It's oil. I'll get to coal a little bit later because that's the biggest surprise of all. And I'll actually get to nuclear right there, but I'll come to that.
So it's 17 billion what? Barrels, gallons, what?
7 billion to 16 billion barrels, which is about 1 to 1.5 years of U.S. consumption.
Uh-huh.
That's in the Arctic Refuge. In the Arctic Ocean, the two oceans I was talking about, Beaufort and the Chukchi Seas, has about 30 billion barrels of oil, which, again, could go on for another 6 years or 5 years or so of U.S. consumption. But that's not how it works. Because of all other energy, they could be drilling there for 30 years because it's one of the sources.
Mm.
So that's oil. Coal is the one that almost nobody in America knows about. And that's what big part of my work is bringing out, is the Western Arctic, a place called the Eutaw River Upland, has 10% of world's coal reserves.
My God.
And the amount is the largest coal deposit in North America. And the total amount is estimated at 3.5 trillion ton of bituminous coal. 3.5 trillion, meaning in U.S. we consume about 1 billion ton of coal each year. So we could be burning that coal for 3,500 years. I'm not joking. 3,500 years we could burn that coal. But there is a great history behind it, and I'll tell you that history because a lot of your listeners are probably interested in nuclear issues, is that particular area had a great history in 1950s when Ed Teller, father of the hydrogen bomb from Los Alamos, came to Alaska with his brilliant plan to detonate 6 large nuclear bombs just outside of Point Hope, the Inupiat community I talked about a little bit earlier, whom I'm fighting with about these legal suits, to detonate 6 large nuclear bombs to create a harbor. And the way he convinced he tried to convince the Alaska businesses and the university and everything else, is that this harbor will be a great economic thing for Alaska because we would get that coal from the Eutaw upland, bring it by train, and then ship it out. Fortunately, native village of Point Hope, just one Inupiat community, activists from there, two scientists from University of Alaska Fairbanks who got fired for fighting for that cause and 30 years later were given honorary degrees for the exact same reason by the same university, University of Alaska Fairbanks, and a couple of conservationists. This grand plan of Taylor was stopped. And that history, and in fact, if it had happened, it would have been a far larger disaster than Chernobyl that happened in Russia. And that history is actually written up by a dear friend of mine, an amazing historian, in a famously award-winning book called The Firecracker Boys. So 60 years later, or about 54 years later, we are at it again to go after that coal. So history is fascinating, isn't it? Like, back then, Taylor wanted to bomb the hell out of that place with nuclear bombs and bring out the coal. And now we are going after that coal, and it's scary. It's really scary.
Well,
a lot of people who say that there is not enough oil and coal, so will anyway be clean energy. It's really not true, though, because that's why the coal and oil lobby fight so hard, because they know this stuff is out there.
Well, it's killing the Earth. I mean, as James Hansen from NASA says, that coal is the most concentrated form of carbon, but also trees are too, that there is. Well, coal's made from trees, and that we must stop burning coal now. So for God's sake, where are these people's heads? I mean, the Obama administration, Shell Oil, what on earth do they think they're up to?
You know, it's a crime. Like the way I say, and you know, Jim Hansen is a good friend of mine. Mm-hmm. I just saw him last November at the Institute for Advanced Study, where he gave a talk. And it's a crime. It's a crime. And that's why, like Hansen, now what he's doing, when he gives his talk, he shows pictures of his grandchildren.
Yeah.
Because he says, I don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
Because I am really fighting for my grandchildren's future here. And so are you. You are fighting for your children and your grandchildren, and it's kind of a crime that these people are committing. And how do we stop that? That's why we are really trying to figure out how to create a movement that we stop this maniacal plan.
Well, maybe I can work with you, eh?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, you interviewed Bill McKibben. Bill is a friend.
Yes.
So we all have to put our heads together to figure out, because I am heartened, because when we fight, individual basis, we do, once public understands, sometimes we do win, but it's not really a win-win, it's a temporary relief. But the hope is that, you know, the thing that I'm trying to bring out is that while the clean technologies are being installed, of course, China is doing in a massive scale while still burning coal and oil, but they are investing $800 billion nearly on clean technology. But by the time all that comes to the market,
it will be too late. Yep.
That's the thing.
Too late,
that's
she
the
cried.
Point.
Yep. It's and now with these Republicans dominating Congress who are scientifically clearly illiterate.
They are, I have to say, they're criminals.
Yeah, I would say
right
that too.
I can say that right now, because it's not that these people don't know what they're doing. They know very well what they're doing, but they'll still do it because of corporate profit and corporate support of corporations. And that's why they're doing this. And that's why, you know, I try to make a distinction between, and I did that in one of my posts, is a distinction between a climate denier and a skeptic. Because I call the politicians and the corporations climate deniers because they know very well what they're doing.
Of course they do.
Whereas general public, who are kind of getting their news from Fox News, is confused and wondering if this is really true or false, are sort of what I would call skeptic. But these people are deniers, and they're doing it deliberately, knowingly, and it's a crime against humanity.
I'll
it's
tell
a crime
you,
against all species on Earth.
Yeah, and I'll tell you another thing, Sabanka, that Murdoch, who is an Australian, who actually championed my career in the early 70s, he's a highly intelligent man. And he's got two little girls.
Where, how is he doing this? Why is Fox News doing that?
Where's the man's head? I mean, has he no responsibility at all for the future? And he's not dumb. This man's very smart.
And you know, it's like, why is he doing that? Like, because it's not that technology doesn't exist. It's not that we don't know how to live sustainably. All of these ways of things are out there. It's just these corporations have taken over the world in a manner that they just don't care.
Yeah.
And our current Congress is, I mean, you talk about it, Fred Upton, who is the chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. He, of course, does not believe in global warming, but he has launched a massive attack on the Environmental Protection Agency. Daryl Issa, the head of the Government Reforms Committee, he just said that he's going to bring all of the Obama people and everybody for a hearing on any of these regulatory means, because he wants to deregulate the entire United States.
I'm interviewing Sabanka Banerjee, an Indian-born American photographer, writer, and revolutionary, let me say. tell us about your experience watching the polar bears and their cubs in their cave.
Yeah, so it's like we can talk about a little bit of the talking about the experience. So in 2002, I mean, you know, the first time I went, I talked about the cold, and I would see Robert Thompson could handle metal parts wearing thin cotton gloves in minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. I thought it's humanly impossible. And Robert would joke with me that go back home and put your hand in ice and keep it there for an hour and you'll be able to do the same thing. So we used to laugh about it. The following year, I am now, when I go to the Arctic, I'm able to do that. With a thin liner gloves, I can operate metal parts in 40, 50 below zero, which you might think is impossible, but I can. And so in one time, we were actually camped out on one of the river deltas, which is actually a very rich in oil and gas, Canning River Delta, one of the largest river deltas in the entire Arctic. And we were observing one of these polar bear dens. But we, of course, stay very far because I'm not interested in a journalistic photograph. I work as an artist. So I'm just observing it from very far. And we saw the bear and the two cubs come out, play outside the den. Then they went back in. And we went back to our tent, which was about a mile and a half away. And then the blizzard started blowing. And it literally blew for 29 days with four calm days. We never saw the bears again because of the blizzard. And we are talking about 45 below zero temperature, 65 miles per hour wind blowing, 120 below zero wind chill for someone from Calcutta. But I had actually fallen in love with the Arctic by that time. So I was actually enjoying it. But then we ran out of coffee. And that's when Robert said, that's it. It's the time to kill each other.
Time to kill each other.
His wife would joke that, how did you guys actually not kill each other in a situation like that? So, and then finally, actually, fortunately, the very day that our coffee ran out, the blizzard started stopping and we finally came back. But the reason that is important story is polar bears do not need anything permanent to den. They just build their dens in temporary snowbanks.
Mm.
And both on sea ice as well as on onshore. But the sea ice melting the way it is and disappearing and thinning, the onshore denning areas become very, very important. And these onshore denning areas are basically on top of these various river deltas because river banks helps create those snowbanks in which they go in the den. Because come spring when the ice melts, snow melts, you won't even see any sign of the bear or the den or anything. Right there is oil. And now these oil companies want to go drill for oil there. So in a way, but one thing to give credit to the Obama administration that he has done, but again, because of legal suits against the Department of Interior, is he has designated a massive area in the entire Arctic Alaskan Arctic, 190,000 square miles. 190,000 square miles. Huge area as critical habitat for polar bears. So now the state of Alaska is trying to file lawsuit against that designation because they know that such designation would help, would hurt the oil and gas industry and all that. So it's all sorts of things are happening up there right now.
Alaska's run by the oil companies. The people's taxes are paid by them. Their education is paid by the oil companies. Roads and the like. It's sort of an unbelievable scenario. But you know, it strikes me, Subanka Banerjee, as you speak, the irony of the situation. Here, the most extraordinary wildlife in the planet, on the planet, is threatened by our activities producing CO2 since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And ironically, underneath where the wildlife spend their summer mating, eating, and reproducing, lies some of the world's largest reserves of coal, oil, and gas, which the companies want to come, dig out, suck up, and drill to make sure the Arctic actually dies and all those species die. That's really what's going on.
I think, Helen, you just said it exactly it is. It's a great irony. The very thing that is all this CO2 is causing the Arctic to disintegrate is the exact same thing these oil companies are going to exacerbate. Actually, one thing I did not mention when I talked about the coal, right there where the coal is, the Utukok upland is exactly where the Western Arctic caribou herd gives birth, which actually was about 500,000 strong as of 2003. And with recent climate change, their numbers are steeply declining. And they are right now about 377,000, which is still a very huge number of caribou, gives birth right on top of that coal Utukop upland. So you really said it right. It's a great irony. Why does it have to be that way? Just where the wildlife is, that's where the coal is. Just where the wildlife is, that's where the oil is. But it just happens to be that way. It's just, that's why for me as an artist, it's these ironies are what we need to talk about, that this is, we can't allow this to happen.
It's a Greek myth and tragedy. That's what it is. So, all right. On that note, we end. But as you talk, I think of the Nuremberg principles when they tried the Nazis. And they came out with this principle, every person is morally responsible for what his or her country does. And I guess I get a little hope from the revolutions happening in the Middle East, number one, and the tiny embryonic revolution that may actually be starting in the United States, in Wisconsin, in Ohio, and elsewhere. So let's keep going, Sabanka, and we'll negotiate after this interview. Now, if people want more information, do you have a web page?
Yes, climatestorytellers.org would be the best place to learn. And it's not just my writing. Now I'm bringing in writers and thinkers all over the world to contribute, because climate change is not going away anywhere. And it's oil, coal, nuclear, natural gas, you just name it, tar sands, coal sands, oil shale. So climatestorytellers.org would be a good place for people to learn more about some of these issues. And we will, I just launched it last year, but now, you know, we have very prominent people like Vandana Shiva contributing. I hope you will contribute about the issue of nuclear energy, because from your site, I'm learning a lot about the impact of nuclear on the CO2 contribution as well.
Is that called nuclearfreeplanet.org? Is that the site you're going to? My site?
Both If You Love This Planet as well as the nuclearfreeplanet.org.
Yeah.
Yes, so I'm learning from there. And it's that I just feel that young people, if we can get them engaged properly, they will fight. They will fight.
Well, the other thing I want you to know is that Sabanka takes the most beautiful photographs, photographs of wildlife. So go to his site and just wallow in the beauty. And, you know, that might really get into your soul, that you are impelled to do something to save these gorgeous creatures. And remember, we're only one species of 30 million on the planet.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you so much for this fascinating interview, Sabanka. You are a revolutionary, and I'd like to help you.
Thank you, Helen. It's a great honor to be speaking with you.
Thank you. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Sabanka Banerjee, an Indian-born American photographer, writer, and activist. He's the founder of climatestorytellers.org. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll have another fascinating program for you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.